Tonight is February 9th, and we are, this is the second week we're talking about the Maral Miprag. I think this is the 11th lecture on the 1500s in Spain. Not Spain, in Europe. They see it in Spain. Okay, so just a few things about the Maral. Last week we spoke a little bit about the golem, which most likely was made up. But I guess he was like one of these figures that you could make up a lot about him. He was just so great, so then maybe they ascribe great things to him.
What's the game to making up a story like this?
I don't know. Just that I guess, you know, it's a great story. You want to put it to somebody. I don't know. But even if you go to Prague today, they'll show you a statue of what the golem looked like. And they even may even have a statue of Maral Miprag. I mean, he was just a great, great figure. We spoke about that. We spoke about his early life. Okay. So just tonight, first for a few things. First of all, I don't recall if I spoke about his wife Peril, if I'm spelling it correctly. But his wife Peril. What happened is while he was in yeshiva, or while he was young, probably while he was still in high school, he was engaged. He became engaged to this lady, Peril. I think she was in fact from Prague. But and what happened is the father promised a large dowry for the Maral Miprag. And what happened is while they were engaged, before they got married, the father lost all his money. And this probably was one of the times when the Jews, you know, they were chased out of their city, and it was like, I'm not going to say which one, which time that could have been. There was a war between two people, and it spilled out over where Peril's family was. But in any case, Peril's father lost all their money. And as a result of that, the father sent a letter to the Maral. Well, he wasn't the Maral Miprag then, but Reb Lowy, and he said, we have to, you know, you're free to break the engagement because we don't have any money to pay for the dowry. So the Maral sent a message back saying something like, I'll break it when Peril breaks it. In other words, if she gets married to somebody else first, then I'll get married to somebody. So it seems that they were, I guess, engaged either for a long time or unengaged for a long time, which could be very unusual because he didn't get married to her till they were like 28. And before then, he was already a rav of a city. And in Europe, it wasn't common. It's very unusual to take a rav who was not married yet. Especially the rav had lots of responsibilities, including marital issues and shilas, etc. Okay, but what happened with Peril? What happened? So Peril became the breadwinner of the family, and she opened up a store. She opened up a bakery. And she had this bakery, this store, and that's how she would eke out a living. And one day, as, you know, she was inside, this soldier came and was galloping by, took out his sword, stabbed the bread, and started to, you know, gallop off with the bread. Well, Peril realized this. So Peril, I guess, somehow she was able to run out, grab the reins of the horses, and said, "You can't take. You have to pay for that bread, because this is a." I'm supporting my mother, my father, myself, and I can't afford to give you the bread. The soldier said, I have not eaten in 3 days. I need to eat this bread. If I don't, I will die. He said, however, and he pulls out a handkerchief or whatever, some handkerchief or some piece of cloth, and he throws it to her, and he says, if I don't return by tomorrow, you can keep this. That was it. Sped off with the thing, with the bread. Doesn't return the next day, doesn't return in 2 days, 3 days. After a week, she takes a look at what he threw her, and she opens it up, and somehow in the cloth or whatever was a stack of gold coins. So she asked the Rav says, no, nope, it's yours, go ahead, keep it. He said, you can keep it. He didn't come back, and that was it. So the father sent a message to the Maral, we have the money, prepare for a wedding. And that was the story on the Maral getting married to Parol. Okay, that's how we got married. It does seem that they got married on later, like in his late 20s, even though they probably were engaged either before they were, you know, in their teens. So this sometime took place. The other two stories are probably not true. I don't know if anybody ever hear of these Kunda tapes. Rabbi Kunda, he has these tapes for kids. So they come up with these great stories, and they ascribe it to the Maral. The first one I didn't hear anywhere else except for the tape. It's called the Talking Coins. But just a quick story is that you had a Jewish butcher, and his store was next to the non-Jewish spice seller. I don't know if he has a name. Somebody who sells spices. A spice seller. And what happened is this non-Jewish spice seller was very, jealous of the Jew. He's making money, and the guy was not. So, the wall between the two stores was paper thin. And one night, he heard the Jew counting, the butcher counting the money. You know, 150, 151, 152, 153 gold coins. So the guy had a great idea. He waited until, the middle of the night. He came back, took a big, axe, but a big, sledgehammers. And he sledgehammered and he broke the wall in between the two stores. And then early in the morning, he goes to the police, and he says, "Police, the butcher broke through into my store last night, and he stole my 153 gold coins." The police come, and they go into the Jewish butcher shop, and they see the thing with the gold coins, and they count out 153 gold coins. So they take the Jewish butcher and they throw him in jail. Now, how do you solve this crime? That was the story. So basically, this is a story as the Maral as a kid even. So the Maral as a kid, he said he had a great idea, and he told his father, who was a rav, says this is what you, and the father was like astounded. You know, the whole tape is he's trying to tell people his idea and how to solve the crime, and nobody's listening. And finally, he told his friends, and his father overheard him. He says, "Oh my gosh, what a great idea." So how'd they figure it out? They said, in the spices, there's no grease. In the butcher shop, there's a lot of grease. So let the coins talk. The coins will say who the owner is. And that's how it comes in. The coins are going to tell us who their owner is. They're going to talk. And he filled up a pot with water, and he threw the coins in. And all this fat came to the top. So that's the talking coins. That's how he... that's the talking coin story. The second one I actually saw written. As a kid, I saw written, in different places. But it's called The Longest Pesach. What happened is it starts where Rabbi... The Maral is walking home at night. And he sees a non-Jewish kid crying. And he says, so he stops. "Why are you crying?" He says, "Well... He has an abusive father, or his parents died, and his uncle or somebody took him in who's abusive to him, and that person makes him sell things every day, sell bread or whatever, and every night he's supposed to come home with X amount of money. And if he doesn't come home with a certain amount of money, then his father beats him up, or his uncle or whoever beats him up. And he's crying. He says, "And I got the gold coin today, like I usually did, and I lost it. I can't find it. And if I go home, I'm going to get beaten up. That's what he was crying. So the Maharal says, here, follow me. So the Maharal takes the kid into his study, opens a drawer. He says, is this like the coin that you lost? Is this the gold coin? And he says, yeah. So the Maharal gives it to him. He says, here, go take it. And that was that. Fast forward about 5-10 years later. So the Maharal studying, you know, it's Erev Pesach, or like the night before Pesach, or, you know, B'dikas Chametz night, or the night before. And there's a knock on the door, and who does he see? This non-Jewish young man. And he says, Rabbi, can I come in? And very strange, he's like looking around, and he says, yes, come in. He says, listen, you don't recognize me, but a few years ago, you know, you did something for me, and I'm going to do something for you. And what happened is he says, I'm now working for this bakery shop, and the plan is that they're poisoning the breads. So if you, when Matzah Pesach, when you all go to buy breads, everybody's going to buy bread, and it's all going to be poisoned, and everybody's going to die. So, you know, I'd like to let you know that information, but if you tell, you can't let them know that you know, because if they know, then they'll know I told you, and they'll kill me. And with that, he leaves. Now what does the Maharal do? You know, okay, he finds out that they're poisoning the bread. You know, so everybody's going to come, they're going to buy the bread, they're going to be poisoned. And if he says something to that kid, they're going to find out that the kid told the rabbi. So as the way the story goes, is the Maharal, the seventh day, the last day of Pesach, he calls a meeting for all the rabbanim in shuls, of all the shuls. He says, everybody come down. They had a meeting in the biggest shul that there was with all the rabbanim. And the way the story goes, he says that we made a mistake. And really, Pesach is one more day. So we're going to be keeping Pesach. A third day. There's a third day yontif this year. There's a real 3-day yontif. Right? So we're keeping yontif, and that's what everybody's going to do. And sure enough, okay, so that came that night, and the bakery opened, and they expected all the Jews to come, right? And nobody's coming. Meanwhile, non-Jews are coming. So they couldn't sell the non-Jews the poison bread, so they started to sell the few non-kosher poison breads that they had. But then more and more non-Jews started coming, and they wouldn't sell them, which caused a ruckus. And then the police came, and they found out that it was poisoned. And that's how the Maharal saved the day. Okay, that's the second story I remember of the Maharal. Now, I guess because of the way who the Maharal was, I mean, they would ascribe stories like that to him. Or maybe it was just like an exotic time in the 1500s in Prague. I don't know. But those are like, that's what the about the... So the first story is true. The last two are probably not true. Okay, I know I mentioned, we mentioned this last year, just a little bit about his history. When he came to Prague, he established a Beis Medrash, which we called the Klaus. He was like a reshiva. He had an educational way of teaching. He always had students. And eventually, towards the end of his life, he also became a Rav. He became the chief rabbi of like all of Poland as well. The Tzemach David, who was his student, says he was there for a period of 11 years, and afterwards he left. We'll see why he left, and I'll tell you shortly. And then he came back for another 4 years. Okay. Posen, Prague. Prague actually really wasn't in Poland. It was, I think this was Austria at the time. Today it's Czechoslovakia, but there was no Czechoslovakia. That was like an artificial country, where they took the Czechs and the Slovakians and they put it together and they called it Czechoslovakia.
Today,
Czech is just Czech, right? Because they got rid of the right. So that changed also. But there was I think under the Austrian Empire.
Yes,
at this time. Okay, so this is Posen. Posen was all the way to the east of Poland and Prague. So this is where he went back and forth from each one. This is basically what Poland was, some sort of treaty. This is Russia over here. This is Lithuania. This is Poland, okay? And these two kept, they were really one country, so to speak, because, like we mentioned before, the king of one, you know, the duchess of one married the daughter of the king of the other. So Lithuania and Poland were always pretty much the same country, at least during this time, and they had to fight off a lot of a lot of other people. We're going to learn in Mitzvah Hashem next time from the east. That's where they're going to come with the Cossacks. They're going to join up with the Tartars, and they're going to have a just going to go through Poland, and just it's just going to be a terrible, terrible tragedy for the Jews. But all right, that'll be next week. I know I mentioned this last week towards the end. The Tosfos Yontif. Tosfos Yontif was one of his students, and the Tosfos Yontif in his preface writes that basically what the Maral did is he brought the study of Mishnayos to the front. It almost seems that before the Maral, people didn't learn Mishnayos as Mishnayos. You know, Mishnayos is all in the Gemara, so they'd be learning. You'd learn Gemara brachas, you learn Gemara Shabbos, but to learn Mishnah as having a Seder in Mishnayos is something that was not common. Taking a look here, and I just picked up. Okay. I just picked up a any volumes, any one of the Mishnayos Yochanan Boaz, it's called. So this Yochanan Boaz, you just, I guess, take a look at it. Okay, good. I think we're still on. Put it there now. Okay, so if you take a look at any page. So inside is the Mishnayos, okay? The Yochanan Boaz is the first Yisrael. He came much later. And on top, on the inside, which would be Rashi in the Gemara, is the Rav Avadya Mibat Tanura. He, again, started in Italy, and he was one of the, in the 1400s even, he was a Rav in Yerushalayim. He became the Rav of Yerushalayim. And this is the Tosfos Yontif is on the outside. It's because Tosfos Yontif, he takes the pshat of the Rav, and he either argues with him, or he brings Gemaras and asks questions from Gemaras, almost like a Tosfos, you know, on the Gemara. So that was the Tosfos Yontif, Yerav Yontif Lipman Heller, who is actually buried in Krakow, he's buried in Krakow in the Ramaz Cemetery. As a matter of fact, he's not buried where all the other rabbis are buried. He's buried further down. And next to him is an undescript grave. And they all tell you what the story was with that grave. There was a person, there's a story where, I'm just trying to remember if I remember his name, Yassel. I guess, man, I'm sure you know the story, but there was in Krakow, there was a very rich person, but he was known as a miser. He wouldn't give anybody any money. And, you know, like people would come, he'd open the door, he'd be nice, cordial, he'd sit down, he'd ask them questions, they'd say, oh, this is their heartache, they have X amount of kids, and they need this or that, and they're sick. And then after a while, he'd say, okay, get out. You giving me any money? No. Okay, and that was that. You know, on his deathbed, you know, finally, after many, many years, so the Chevra Kadisha came, you know, he's very sick, and the Chevra Kadisha came to him with a bill. Now, the bill wasn't just for the burial. The bill was for about 20 years of helping, you know, feeding tzedakah and not giving his share to poor people and everything. And he said no. And I said, we're not going to bury you. And he said, look, you do what you want. And the Rav came in. The Rav tried to, you know, get it, you know, I think it was the Tosfos Yontif tried to get him to retract, and no. But he pulled out of his pocket, he pulled out an envelope, and he gave it to the Rav. So the Rav put it in his pocket. And shortly after he died, this Yassela died. Of course, the Chevra Kadisha wouldn't bury him. So this Yassela's family had to, you know, dig a grave, and they buried him. The next Thursday... evening, a lady knocks on the Tosfos Yontif's door, and she says, I need money, I'm poor. You know, Tosfos Yontif gives money. 10 minutes later, there's another knock on the door. Somebody else asks, gives that person too. In another 5 minutes, another person knocks. Now, at this point, these people never knock on the door. So he said to the third person, like my high, like what's going on? Like, why are you coming now? You know, this sounds like your situation has been for a long time. He says, yeah, but every Wednesday night, Thursday morning, or whatever, I used to find an envelope, like, under the front door mat, you know, or I used to find money, you know, and this week it wasn't there. After he left, two or three more people came, and then more people came, and then that's it. Tosfos Yontif realized something's up here. So, and he was finding out that all the other rabbis were also having this situation. So they called an emergency. This is Thursday night already. Friday morning, they told, let's everybody pool our foods and try to give out to as many people as possible until they could figure out what was going on. Who was the cause of all, you know, where was all this money coming from? Why did it stop? And sure enough, they all of a sudden they put two together and they realized it was coming from Yasala the miser. And the Tosfos Yontif realizes, he opens up the envelope and it says, I leave all my money, whatever money I have left, I leave it to the people of Krakow. And they went into his house. Imamish had nothing left. At the end of his life, he was like poor. So the Tosfos Yontif said, you know, basically they did whatever they had to do with all the poor people to make everything up. But he says, I want to be buried next to this Yasala. So you can go today to that cemetery in Krakow, right next to the Ramaz Shul, and see all the Gedolim are buried up in front. And then you go further down, you see Tosfos Yontif, and next to it is like a nothing of a grave. It's a grave with like a, I don't think there's anything written on that stone. All right, at least that's what my tour guide told me. Maybe you'll hear something else from your tour guide. Okay, so I got to get back to, is this what I got to do? Yeah, okay. So so that was the Tosfos Yontif. So basically what the Tosfos Yontif said is he started like a revolution, a new type of learning, and that is learning of Mishnayos. Today, I just, it's a very, very big, today, you know, the third, fourth, fifth graders in all of our elementary schools, that's basically what their main learning is. Their main learning is Mishnayos. And it was brought back because the Tosfos Yontif says that was the morale. The morale, started this the learning of Mishnayos. Again, this is what I had showed you. Tosfos Yontif is on the outside. Inside is Rav Mibat Tanura. This is more, looks like more of a fancy picture. Okay, just moving on. These are the Svarim of the morale. The Gor Aryeh Ala Torah. So this is a commentary on Rashi. This is today you can buy the Gor Aryeh Sefer in of itself, but if you buy a Sefer called the Mizrahi, so the Mizrahi has about five or six Perushim, including his own, on Rashi, and he includes the Gor Aryeh, which is the Maral. And basically, the commentary on Rashi is Rashi is giving Pashut Pshat in the Chumash. Why did Rashi pick this and not this? Sometimes he brings a Medrash. What are you bringing a Medrash for? Sometimes he brings two explanations. Why did he bring two? So, you know, they'll say, well, the first one he got from, it says this, you know, this word and not a different word, and the second Pshat is as well, it says this and not that. So they all come in and try to explain why Rashi picked the pshat that he did. Chidushi Agadas al Talmud Bavli. I don't know if we'll get to it tonight. I don't know if we'll get to it. But basically, he there are a lot of agadatas that just are very hard to explain. And what the Maral did is he gave you a pshat to explain the agadatas. Because otherwise it sounds crazy, a person who says, come on, this can't be, it's impossible. I have at the end here an example of that. So, Nesivas Olam is Musar, Gvuras Hashem, which we're going to start now. Gvuras Hashem, Netzach Yisrael, Tferes Yisrael, these are all on different parts of the year. Derech Chaim is Avos, Beragola is Shas and Midrash, that was okay is pshat, and then near mitzvahs on Chanukah and Purim. Agadah shel Pesach. He also has this is a Gor Aryeh. This is somebody wrote a perish on the Gor Aryeh. So now this is not just the Gor Aryeh; it's Rashi's Gor Aryeh and Rabbi Hartman's perish on the Gor Aryeh. Gvuras Hashem, which is this is one of his first sfarim that he came out with, and it's on Pesach. So he writes in the preface, Gvuras Hashem, divided his sfarim into six books. First is history and philosophy. Second book deals with Pesach Seder. He calls that part the Sefer HaGibor. Third part is the Tiferes Yisrael, that we saw before, which is about Shavuos, giving of the Torah. Next one is Sefer HaNetzach, which talks about Tisha B'Av. Then comes Sukkos, a Sefer HaHod. The next one is Sefer Shemayim V'Aretz, talks about Yom Kippur. I don't think he ended up, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, I don't think he ended up printing this Sefer. In other words, he wrote in the in Gvuras Hashem, in the introduction, that he has all these Sfarim, these different parts, but this Sefer here, I don't think he ended up printing yet. And he did other Sfarim in front, before. And he says, why is it called Gvuras Hashem? Because Zechel Yetzias Mitzrayim, it all talks about the Makos, and that all has to do with the Gvuras Hashem. Okay. Okay. I have over here a speech that a Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. Now, the Shabbos Shuvah Drasha is 5344, which is 5784. Now, we mentioned before that he was in Prague for about 11 years, and then he left, and he came back for another 4 years. So what happened is this is the Shabbos Shuvah Drasha before he left. Before he left. What happened is he was the Rosh Yeshiva in the town. He had his yeshiva, the Klois. And the Rav either, I believe, passed away or left. And basically, they didn't have somebody to give the Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. So they asked the Maral to give the Drasha. I guess this Drasha would have been some sort of like a prabha, so to speak. If it was good, then maybe they would ask him to stay on as the rabbi of Prague as well. So things he says here, it's very, I found it very like instructive, just so you get an idea on what was going on in Prague at the time. So he opens up he says that power, right, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, but he says that power buries its owner. And is why he brings up his proof is that these four, Hosea, Yeshaya, Amos, and Micha, all outlived four kings. You know, they all were prophesied during four kings. In other words, the kings' lives were shortened, and the Nevi'im, they were longer. The reason why the kings' lives were shortened, because they let it get to their head. And once that happens, then they don't stay kings for so much long. This is like a typical, very nice morale. He says, you take the word melech. So melech has three letters, a mem, a lamed, and a chaf, right? So it comes, these three letters come after the yud. So in the aleph base, it's yud, chaf, lamed, mem, right? But if you start with the mem, mem, lamed, chaf is melech. So he says that that's because in order for a king to be a king, he needs a congregation. And that's yud. Yud is 10. Then when you have your congregation, then it's melech. I'm just like saying things here. He says, melech is going from melech, lamed chaf, it's facing the yud. So the king always has to be facing the congregation. He always has to be looking towards them, seeing what they need. And in particular, he always has to be looking at those that are needy, the poor, you know, I guess, and the poor, and that you see that from the yud. The yud is a small little letter. I guess he's talking about the leadership in Prague at the time. I guess this is his way of telling the leadership that you got to get your act together. You're not doing what you should be doing. You're more interested in yourself than the congregation. Okay, the mem. What else did he say here? He should pay extra. Okay, I said this. Yud is the first letter. It's the smallest. Impoverished people. Okay. I'm sorry?
Where is the yud actually? What word is this yud in?
No, so if the aleph base. Aleph base, gimel, dalet, hey, vav, zayin, ches, tes, yud. The next three letters of the aleph base is chof, lamed, mem. So it's mem, lamed, chof is melech. he's spelling the word Melech in the Aleph base. What's in? What's the next letter? Is the Yud. So a Melech is a king because it's after the Yud. When you have a congregation, then you can have a Melech. And the Yud represents the small people. And the Melech is going from Mem to Chaf. It's towards the direction of the Yud. It's looking towards the Yud. Right. That's how, you know. Okay. Okay. Now, he talks over there about Lashon Hara. And he starts talking about Lashon Hara. And he did something there that was very powerful. He starts talking about how, why is Lashon Hara worse than the three big Gaveras? Avodah Zarah, Shvichas Damim, and Arayos. He says, because when a person sins with a certain part of the body, that part of the body is ruined. But Lashon Hara, which is the essence of man, this ruins the entire body. That's why Lashon Hara is worse. Now, that's what I said here. Now, what was happening at the time was something called the Nadler controversy. Nadler. Does any familiar with this? Anything? Okay. So this comes from the Marshal. The Marshal is writing about the Nadler, and then I go back to the speech of the Maral. But the Nadler writes, there was a rumor about a brother who married a sister. What happened is the brother and the sister, and I guess it was they had to run away, and they went separate ways. And they were both younger when they left, and 10 years later, they meet again, and he probably put on a beard, and they don't recognize each other. Maybe the boy was a little younger than the girl, so he may not have remembered it so much, but whatever. And they were engaged to be married, and basically what happened is they were really brothers and sisters. So what happened is she noticed that he had some congenital mole. And Nadler is what? It's like a nipple, and Nadler is a mole. I'm sorry, Nadler is a mole. So that's basically what happened is they get into shock, and she realizes, she says, oh no, you are you. Yeah, and then they realize that they're brothers and sisters, and then they separate. They go their own separate ways. So this is what the Marshal is saying. So they fled from each other, but the rumors were widespread that they had family and children, and all the kids that come from there are mamzerim. So you have people that they were called Nadler. They were called Nadler the Mole. Now, the family, they say that they do come from this brother and this sister, but either one of a few things happened. Either what happened is that they did get married, but they left each other, and then they had families from different. They both remarried, and everybody comes from the two families. They're not mamzerim. The second one is either that the whole story never happened. Some say that they realized it before they got married. But in any case, this is what the Marshal this is the Amshal Shlomo Marshal brings down, that all the Gedolim checked into this, and everybody is telling you that it's lies. Whoever says this is saying Lashon Hara. This major family has now married. They had lots of children on both sides, whatever, and they married into the most prestigious families of Klal Yisrael. And if you're calling one person a Nadler, and that means a Mamzer, a Nadler, then you're calling everybody. And the Marshal says, he writes, if anyone calls anyone a family by the nickname Mole, even though he did not expressly call him a Mamzer, it is equivalent, and he deserves flogging. Makas, whatever, and he must appease the other parties detailed above. Okay. Now, what happened during the Maral speech? Now we got talking about Lashon Hara. So he writes that, So he writes, he actually, at that point, he says that this is a ban. They already had made a ban in the past. This is the Maral's talking at that Shabbat Shuvah Drasha. And after that, he pulls out 10 Sifrei Torah. Okay, if you had mentioned, he remakes the ban again, and he pulls out 10 Sifrei Torah, and they make the curse and the ban again at that Shabbat Shuvah Drasha. I guess everything that was said before was not enough. People who, you know, got into fights, or, you know, and then the Lashon Hara was something that was not, it wasn't taken as serious, or the hatred or was more serious, it was more meant more to the people than the Isser of Lashon Hara, and they kept kept at it to the point where the Maral later came again and right then and there took 10 Sifrei Torah out and made the excommunication again with the curses. We issued a terrible and awesome ban with 10 Sifrei Torah through the with the scholars of Prague. I guess he got all the big rabbanim to each one of them holding a Sefer Torah. It's befitting to observe the ban issued by the previous generations in addition to this ban that was issued in public. And that was done at the Shabbos Shuv for Drasha. Needless to say, he didn't get the job. Listen, they figured, you know what, let's get somebody else. So what ended up happening is the Nadler is also by, he writes about it in his Nesivas Olam, the same thing. What ended up happening is they gave it to his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law received the job as the Rav. And after that, the Maral moved to Posen. They left Prague and they moved to Posen. So the question is why? So is it that he was like sour grapes? They don't want me left. So they say one of a few reasons. One reason is that because it was his brother-in-law, he didn't want people to think that he's going to be upset with his brother-in-law. And if anything came out bad, if people were saying bad things about the brother-in-law, which I guess you see it was an issue, speaking bad about other people with Nadler, and you know, if they start saying bad things about the Rav, so the Maral didn't want the Rav or other people to think that it originated from the Maral. In other words, if somebody wanted to say something bad about, I think it was Rabbi Katz who had the position for the next 4 years, I'm not sure if Katz is his son-in-law, but if somebody wanted to say bad things, they'll say, I just heard from the Maral that the Rav is this. And they believe it because the Maral didn't get the job and his brother-in-law did. So therefore the Maral said, let me get out of town. Another reason they say is because his brother-in-law was more into a type of learning, into drush, into a pilpul. And the Maral was very much against pilpul. So maybe he figured at the time, again, in order not to get into controversy or not to have any issues, he left and went to Posen for a few years. Eventually he'll come back. His brother-in-law leaves the rabbinate, doesn't stay on, for whatever reason, and they once again invite the Maral back, and then he does become the Rav at that time. Okay, now this is 4 years later. This is his next Shabbos Tshuva Drasha, and he starts off, so again, this is the one in 1589, the last one with the Nadler, with the Melech, talking against the community in Lashon Hara was in 1584. 5 years later, he says, he starts talking about the Nesiim. I received from the Mementos the reason this section of the Nesiim is adjacent to the Brachos Kohanim is to teach you that this peace which Hashem bestows upon us will be through the princes when they're united. When the Nesiim and the Torah, they were all united, nobody wanted to outdo anybody else, they all gave the same carbon, and there's peace among the Nesiim, then that's when there will be real peace. He says the Prague was ruled by a committee of leaders. I'm not sure if it was 20, I forgot the number, 19 or 20, 23, a whole bunch of leaders. And they decided the policy for all of Prague. And they had one leader of them all. And he's on the Shabbos Shuvah Drash, he's talking about the primus, the primate. He says this is a Gentile custom to have one over the others, and may it be as well to become unified, because I guess that primate or primus was causing problems with the other leaders. And he starts coming out against him. Okay, and that's his next one. So he starts talking about the leader. Okay. Again, I guess the same issues that they were having with the leaders. There's a famous thing that happened with the Maral, his meeting with King Rudolf, the emperor. And it's really, the Shema Gedolim says that the King Rudolf, Emperor Rudolf, asked to speak to the Maral, and they spoke for some time. I don't know if it was about a half an hour, an hour, and then that's it. And then they left. But it was a historic meeting because never had an emperor asked like to speak to the great rabbi of the day. And what was spoke about, we really don't know. The Sefer Tzemach Devot, again, the Tzemach Devot is a Talmud of the Maral. He also brings that down. He says, third of Adar, what's today? No, today's not the third. Is today the third of Adar? No, today's like the fourth or fifth. All right. Third of Adar, 1592, Emperor Rudolf asked to see the Maral. They received him graciously. They spoke directly as one would speak a close friend. The nature of the matters we discuss are completely secret and unknown. Now, in 1872, there was a paper that was written in Hamagid. That's the name of a paper. They found this handwritten account in a Mikros Gedolos, in the beginning of a Mikros Gedolos, that was written in the 1590s. So this Mikros Gedolos, they found this handwritten account, which pretty much says the same thing as at Tzemach David in the Shem Yishmuel, just gives a lot of details. It doesn't say what they spoke about, and it's written in as if, maybe it was, as if his son-in-law of Katz was writing it, who escorted the Maral. He writes over here the 10th of Adar, so like already there's a red flag to this because the Tzemach David said it was the 3rd of Adar. But all right, it is off by a week. So here he writes a lot of details. He says the Emperor Rudolf, through Count Berthier, ordered Mordechai Meisel and Yitzchak Wiesel to bring my father-in-law. Okay, and he took with him the Goyen, Rav Sinai, myself, which is Rav Katz, his son-in-law, and Yitzchak. So these four went with the Maral to meet the emperor. We arrived there, one of the servants of the council unlocked one of the outer chambers. The chambers opened up into one chamber, into another, and there were different doors coming. Each chamber you can get in from different ways. The count appeared coming from one of the inner chambers and inquired about our welfare. After showing great respect, bowing to us, he sat us down on a couch that had been specifically prepared for us in a most dignified manner. We were forced to sit there with our hats on as the count stood before us and briefly spoke with us very politely. He then took leave of us. He went to the innermost chamber. There, together with his servant, he prepared a very dignified-looking sofa and another sofa of lower height across from it. He came to us and asked my father in the Maral to go with him. And he told the Maral to sit on the more expensive, the more chashuv sofa, which he didn't want to, but he did. He ended up doing it. He spoke to him regarding secret matters in a raised voice, so that both of us heard everything clearly, every letter and word. So they were speaking together, but they were speaking loud. And we were a little further away, but we heard everything. The reason why they did this was done on purpose because there was a curtain there. And standing behind the curtain was the emperor. So suddenly there was a hush, some movement of the couches, and our master, the emperor and his majesty, opened the curtain, and there stood the emperor himself. He spoke with my father-in-law for a little while. The distance between us was about 8, maybe 6 cubits. What's 8 feet? 8 cubits is about 16, 20 feet. My father-in-law and the count continued speaking for a short while. Then he escorted my father-in-law back to us. They walked hand in hand. The count acted very submissively towards him, and he stretched his hand out to each of us, respectfully bowed as we left in peace, as we escorted to the courtyard. He writes, I can't tell you now what that conversation was all about, but maybe in the future I'll be able to. And that's basically what it, this is today, Monday, the 11th of Adar. The count revealed to Yitzchak how my father-in-law, the Goyen, saw the king, and he found favor in the eyes of the emperor. Fine. And that's the account, the same account that was written in some Mikros Gedolos, handwritten, and that's, more detail. Okay. There is one thing I wanted to do that One more thing. Oh, two more things. First of all, Maharal educational system. He was very against. He had very strong feelings about education. So, for one, he's against Popel, which was very popular in Poland at the time. He also held that, you know, in terms of what people should study, how they should try to get to the real halacha of things. But one thing, he says, he writes, he tried his hardest. This is to try, you know, all his life, he's trying to get people to change and follow his way of learning, the way he feels it should be. And they all kept answering him back, well, everybody else does it differently, we're just going to stay with the way they are. But one thing in particular he doesn't like. He says, you know, the kids, what they do is, one thing is he didn't like is that the rich people were not providing yeshiva education for the poor people. So that was happening throughout the history. Rich people always took care of all the students, and it was not happening there in Prague. They were only concerned about their own children. And he says, you don't get to see out the Shmaya. The Gemara says, be careful of the poor students because Torah is going to come from them. So when the rich people help educate the poor people, then even their kids become learned in Torah. But if they don't, and the Torah says, who says I'm going to be by you? I don't want to be necessarily by you. And nobody ends up learning. The second thing is he says, what happened is that people were learning the Parsha. Every week you'd learn about a few psukim. I feel guilty because that's what we do. You know, that's what I do in my class, is you go through the parsha, you go through as much as you can, and then the next week you go to the next parsha Shavua. You know, you come home, you want to give what's going on in the parsha, so you give a summary. And he was very much against that because the students, they didn't learn Chumash properly. They didn't know any sugya, any parsha of the Torah well. And then when they got to the Gemara, they didn't know the sources, they didn't know the psukim, and that's what Gemara, a lot of Gemara is getting from the source. So he was very, very against that. This is against the poor, and later, and also the, and then also the, how to learn in terms of the parsha. I just want to end off with one. Okay, this is an example where if you could read a Agadata, and it doesn't make sense, and the Maral wrote a Perush on Agadata to make sense out of it. My understanding of Agadata, and if you read Gemara, so most of the Gemara is halachic, you know, it's the regular Gemara. You have a question, you have an answer, you know, based on the Mishnah. But sometimes you get all these stories in the Gemara, and some of the stories are crazy. They just don't make sense. Like, what? He talks about these crazy big animals, or he speaks about animals like we're going to see that live for a long time. What's it go? What's with it? So the Mahalach is that the Chachamim wanted to get secrets. There were certain secrets that they had that they wanted to pass on to the next generation. But what do? If you write it down, it's not secret anymore. If you don't write it down, it's going to be forgotten. So they wrote the secrets, they coded the secrets in the Agadata. And that's how in the Agadata, if you understand how to read Agadata, you'll be able to figure out the secrets. So here it is. Here's one. He says, it says in the Medrash and Perkei de Rabbi Elazar, Lamed Aleph, Moshe took his wife and sons and he readied them to ride on the donkey. So Perkei de Rabbi Elazar says, this is the same donkey that Avram rode. So Avram was what? How many years before? 400 or 500 years earlier, right? Because from the birth of Yitzchak to Yetzias Mitzrayim was 400 years, right? So that's the same donkey that Avram rode, you know, so maybe a little less than 400 years. And it's the same donkey upon which Moshe rode. And this is the same one upon which King Mashiach will ride. So what's going on? Like, you know, so yes, first of all, what difference does it make whether it's the same donkey or a different one? And like, who cares if it's a donkey? And how is it possible for that donkey to be alive for 3,000 years? So his mahalach is what does a donkey represent? The donkey represents lack of knowledge, like ignorance. says that three times in human history the world was lacking knowledge and wisdom. Just like a donkey which is empty and vacuous. The reason is at the time of Avram the world was shrouded in darkness. And they didn't even know that there was Hashem until Avram came along and made him fluent in the mouth of people. That's what it means that he saddled a donkey. In his days, the world was like a donkey, and he saddled them and taught them about Hashem. So also Moshe, who brought the Torah down in the world. He brought before him, there was very few people that knew Torah, whatever, and he taught the world Torah. So you had a world without Torah, and Moshe was the world, taught the world with Torah. And Mashiach, at the time of Mashiach, he's also going to come. He's not going to be he's going to, when the time of Mashiach, he is going to be, he's going to have, the whole world is going to know Deyas Hashem, Kiyam Liyam Mechasim. Like water covers the world, everybody's going to know of Hashem. There's going to be a lack of knowledge of I guess, also Torah or Hashem. And Mashiach is going to come and teach the world. And that's how he explains the Gemara that they all saddled the donkey. So, and this is just one example of many Agaritas that he explains. And so Agaritas that you see that don't make sense, so there's a hidden meaning behind it. And that's what the Maral in one of his sperm came to do. Okay, he passed away in the beginning of 1609, I think. He also, this is his philosopher, as a philosopher, he's a very, very big philosopher. I want to just go to the end, the inscription on his grave, in 1609, the overpowering lion, he was known, the Gor Aryeh. Gor is a young lion, Aryeh is a big lion. You know, he was known as the lion who dwelled in the heights and the depths, had permission to freely ascend to the divine realm, who entered every level of Pardes. Pshat Rem is so drash. The part of peace, he was wiser than all those who studied and analyzed Torah and didn't neglect any area, minor or major. He gathered and accumulated knowledge and created countless sperm and composed at least 15 major works. His cheeks were adorned with ornaments of Torah, written in oral, were bound under his cloak. In all areas of wisdom and science, he was outstanding. He provided members of the generation with the bread of the mighty. His responses, his Netzach Yisrael, Gvuras Hashem, novel insights on the six orders of Mishnah, and Gemara Rashi Taisus. They are toward the forest and in the ingenious and brilliant Pilpulim. He was a true shepherd and scattered flock. From the inscription of the Maram's great song. Okay? This is a parallel space. Okay? Anyway, so that's the Maral. It was, I guess, larger than life, so to speak. And I guess this was the height, the zenith of Polish Jewry. This is all the late 1500s and the beginning of the 1600s. There's going to be another 30, 40 years of everything flourishing, and then is going to come the Chmelnytsky's rebellion. And that, Mitzvah Hashem, I think we're going to start to cover next week. And that's the end of it. Poland is not going to be the same afterwards, and Polish Jewry will not have this, this situation, the way it is now. Wealth and prestige, and things are going to take a big turn once that happens.